Yeah, we put money down, but we lost it tonight because basically they scored through like a penalty, which doesn't count on the bet. So
no,
yeah.
That's not it at all. So it was the bet was for England to win, but they had to win within the first, you know, 90 minutes of the game. If they don't win, if there's no winner, then it goes to extra time. If there's still no winner, then it goes to penalties. And because it went to extra time, my bet didn't fucking go through, which is kind of sucks. But
sucks.
England did win, so it's not all completely lost. And, you know, I don't have to, like, punch a wall or anything tonight.
Are you, like, a sports fan? Do you know anything about soccer?
Not really. I've never been a... I mean, I do sports, but I've never really watched them.
Oh, really? What sports do you do?
I'm a runner. I do distance running.
Oh,
I run
sick.
In a lot of
awesome.
Races. Yeah.
Awesome.
But,
awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, yeah. Would you like to sort of introduce yourself to our audience, like let people know what you're about, where they can find you?
Yeah, sure. My name is Leighton Woodhouse. I am a documentary filmmaker. I principally kind of think of myself as that, but I'm also a writer and a journalist. I've actually been a writer and a journalist for longer than I've been a documentary filmmaker, but these days I think of my primary thing is filmmaking. You can find me on Twitter, of course, unfortunately, at L Woodhouse. And then also now I get to plug my Substack because I started a Substack a couple of months ago.
Yes.
So, yeah.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. Everybody has a Substack now. I feel so much pressure, but it's like the discipline of like staying on top of it is like what's sort of deterring because there's already so much like to do generally and stuff. But yeah. Everybody go check out all of the things listed. Moving into the docket, I thought it would be interesting to talk about the Bill Cosby thing that's going on. He's been let free from jail, and apparently it was to do with the fact that it wasn't. They used like evidence from the civil case in the criminal case, so that was sort of like a contradiction, and that was the technicality they used to get him out on. And there's been this really like, you know, weird response, especially within the Black community, who sort of see him as this sort of heroic figure. And it kind of reminds me of the OJ Simpson case in the sense that it's like one of those situations where it becomes evident that, like, you know, this whole wokeness and the whole kind of like, you know, racialized, like, you know, aspect of culture isn't really about, you know, actual justice. It's all about getting Black people institutional perks in that sense, which is kind of what I'm noticing. What do you think about it?
Is the Black community like rallying behind Cosby? I ask that genuinely because I have not been paying close attention. I don't know, but I haven't seen that a whole lot of like, you know, it seems I know Felicia Rashad and like people who know him personally have been rallying to his defense, but, you know, I certainly haven't noticed anything like OJ in the 90s. It feels as if most people understand.
I was just saying, yeah, I've definitely noticed on social media that there have been people sort of making, you know, this sort of argument about the fact that he's Black and how Black men are treated differently and sort of comparing his case to, you know, Harvey Weinstein or other prominent quote unquote white figures who haven't necessarily seen jail time in the same way that like Cosby has. So it seems as if like it's shifting towards this sort of racialized argument rather than like a focus on like the problems with these sorts of, you know, cases and the justice in them at all.
Yeah, well, it's funny actually because, you know, now that I think about it, it was a Black comedian who kind of brought the public's attention to the Cosby situation in the first place. I mean, it had been kind of not very well kept secret in Hollywood, but it was Hannibal Buress who went on tour and made that joke about Cosby that kind of like fixated the media on in the first place. So this really, you know, it came from another Black comedian in the first place. So it feels like maybe we have gotten, you know, a little bit more complicated than at least in the 90s with OJ.
I guess so. But you're also seeing the same sort of narrative sort of spun around someone like Ghislaine Maxwell, for instance. People are sort of making the argument that Epstein and others were given these sweetheart deals that, you know, she's not getting access to. And because she's a woman, you know, we should make things fair by giving her leniency in that sense.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about, because, I mean, OJ didn't get a sweetheart deal. The glove didn't fit. So that's like how it goes.
Well, no, it's not necessarily just about that. It's about the fact that like identity politics is now kind of making its way into the argument in a way that sort of detracts from the overall kind of systemic fault lines that are causing these things in the first place. And I'm seeing it a lot, even with the Olympics that's going on at the moment. I forget the name of the girl, but she's like a black runner. Right. She's a black athlete. And she was caught with marijuana in her system.
Right.
So she's now obviously not allowed to go to Tokyo. And that is now also being racialized. You know, they're saying that, you know, the Olympics committee is like racist because they're not having leniency with this specific like case or issue.
Right. I mean, in this case, I side with the athlete just because the rule is ridiculous. Like, I mean, if you can cream the competition while stoned on weed, then it seems to me that you're even more qualified to be on the team, not less qualified. It's not as if it's a performance enhancing drug, you know. But that said, I do hear pretty cases, but I certainly see what you're saying in terms of like some of these cases of police shootings over the last couple of years in the U.S. Like, for example, you know, in some cases, you've got like cases like Philando Castile, you've got cases like George Floyd, where it is, you know, pretty much incontrovertible that this stuff was the police, you know, murdering somebody just in cold blood with no pretext whatsoever. But in other cases, you know, you've got people who, what's the guy's name? His name is slipping my mind now, but the guy who I think it was in Atlanta who had his girlfriend had a restraint on him, and he a temporary restraining order on him. He had sexually assaulted her in front of her kids. He had showed up to her house, and he was in the process of apparently like possibly abducting their children from her. You know, he didn't have custody over the kids, and they were in the back seat. And then at that point, a cop showed up. He was reaching into the back seat for a knife and was shot. And then, like, you know, this is like not a sympathetic case. You know, this is not a case in which you can. So, like, in those cases, I have absolutely seen this double standard where it's like, you know, based on the guy's identity, not just his identity, but the identity of the assailant, which meaning a police officer, completely prejudices the understanding of basic facts of the situation in the way that you're describing, for sure.
Yeah. And that's one of the things that I've been sort of worried about now is there's like it's almost as if like this sort of racialized analysis is like take an ontological primacy over like every other area of analysis and is sort of being kind of drummed up in really inappropriate ways that often point towards like either a desire for institutional perks or a desire to like avoid responsibility. Mm-hmm. And like that is something that I think is incredibly pernicious and like hurts the cause for racial equality.
Mm-hmm. Just bringing it back to like the Olympics, like example, I guess, like I totally agree with you, Leighton. Like it's, if you can beat him whilst you're stoned, then it's even better. And it shouldn't even be it shouldn't even be on the list of performance enhancing drugs or whatever.
But like, everybody knows
that
they're
should
super
be an event. They should just have like, you know, javelin throwing while stoned.
Yeah. Let's do
the stoned Olympics. Yeah. I like that.
Just like hacky sack and like frisbee.
Adult
like
swim will definitely pick that up.
No, but then again, everybody knows how strict the Olympics are.
Exactly.
I mean, even insulin is like, you know, something that could hurt your chances of getting through. And, you know, that, you know, a parent of hers recently died, and she said that she was using it as like sort of a cope in that sense. And of course it's human, it's understanding, and people were really excited about her because she had this sort of authenticity and they were, you know, rooting for her. But I don't think that we can blame it on racism. And I think there's like a push to like racialize everything that I find really kind of pernicious.
Yeah. I would agree that I don't see any indication that it's racially motivated. I do, however, think that it's ironic that, like, that with this kind of prudishness around, you know, taking a smoking some weed or taking an edible or whatever she did versus the, like, cavalier way in which we are allowing people on hormone replacement therapy to compete in the Olympics, which, you know, I don't have a problem with trans people competing in competitive sports or people on hormone replacement therapy competing in professional or amateur sports. But it like, let's be real, like, it is a thing, right? There's, like, if there's extra testosterone in your system, that is performance enhancing. Like, let's not pretend that chemistry and biochemistry doesn't exist just because there's a political stake at issue. And if you're going to be that, you know, if you're going to be that prudish about smoking a little weed, then it just seems a little bit ridiculous that you could be so cavalier about something as baldly performance enhancing as testosterone.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's not even just like a little bit of extra hormones. Like, there was this New Zealand weightlifter that's come around who was a world competing male weightlifter for, you know, 20 years, and now at like 40 something is now transitioned and is like competing in the women's. And it's sort of like, I don't know if that's if they compete and like they smash it, then everyone will be absolutely mad. But then I guess if they compete and they don't smash it and they completely fail, then it sort of like throws the whole argument up in the water. So it'll be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not trying to get, not to change the subject from the race issue, but there's been this big, I don't know if you guys saw that in LA last weekend, there was this huge protest in front of the spa because there was a trans person. Yeah. You know what I'm talking about?
I remember
with
that. Yeah.
A woman and her son, right?
No, it was the black lady, and I think she was with a daughter she was with, or something. Yeah, right. I remember.
Yeah, the setup is that a trans woman was in the locker room, and you know, this is pre-op or non-op or whatever, so that this trans woman had a penis. And was like, you know, basically had her penis out in the locker room in the women's locker room with children present. And, you know, this one woman was livid about it. And it seemed as if there was other women in line when she was shooting this video who were asking for money back too. So I think there were more than just her who were livid about it. You know, it is what it is. Then there was this protest protest was called by people who wanted to protest the spa for allowing this to happen. And then a counter protest was called by Antifa, just immediately the whole thing turned into this absolute shit show where, like, you know, here's the thing, like, trans people obviously have civil rights and human rights, which should be respected. Among those, I would say, debatably, is the right to be treated as a woman in a women's only space, like a women's locker room. In other words, I could see the case being made that is a right or should be a right of trans women. On the other hand, there's also a right for women in general to be able to have a space in which they, where they are not exposed to like male genitalia, or people who are men who identify as women but pass to everybody else as men. These are two rights that I think are legitimate, and in this case, they obviously nakedly conflict. In this case, they conflict just head to head in the case of this spa. But it's like, can we be adults about this and tease apart this stuff rationally and say, okay, we've got two competing rights that conflict with each other. How are we going to sort it out in a democratic society? Instead of, you know, the rally that was called against the spa was the poster said that it was a rally, like an anti-pervert rally. So immediately the trans woman is a pervert. And then the Antifa response was like an anti-transphobe thing. And of course that morphs into white supremacists and all this stuff that has nothing to do with the issue at hand. But yeah. it becomes like fascist, transphobe, and then it's just like name calling. It's just one side calling the other side perverts, yeah. and the other side yeah. calling the other yeah. side bigots, and no, mm-hmm. just like recognition of the basic fact that yeah, sometimes there are rights that are equally valid and that conflict, and we have to figure out a way to live together in a society and to come up with rules and regulations and laws that yeah. represent compromises between conflicting yeah. parties.
Yeah, the culture war machine always like ratchets up to like 10 whenever yeah. something like this happens, and there's no sort of nuance position in between, and you're not really allowed to have complicated feelings about anything these
right.
days.
Right.
You have to like choose a side. And when it comes to this specific issue, I do have complicated feelings about it, because I do understand like the grievances of trans people. But also, if I saw a penis in a, you know, women's only space, I probably would be alarmed by that.
Yeah.
And if I was with like a young child, a daughter, I probably would have sort of a visceral reaction to that.
Yeah.
Because it's you know.
Well, also a bit of like sort of personality thing here. I don't know how it is in like the women's locker rooms, but I haven't been to a locker room where guys are just walking around with their dicks out. Are women walking around with their beef out? Like,
I mean,
there's
that's
nothing
not
dangling, so there's nothing really. I guess you're looking. I mean, in some unfortunate cases, there's some stuff dangling, but you know,
ew, mental image. No, I've never seen beef in a female's in a female locker room before.
So that's what I'm saying. It's kind of like a personality thing as well, right? Like, you got to be a kind of person to walk around with your genitals exposed in a locker room.
I mean, most people do try to be discreet in changing rooms, yeah. mainly just out of, you know, embarrassment mm-hmm. and, you know, general regard yeah. for the people around you. And yeah, that's why I thought it was odd. The statement was that this person was sort of shamelessly walking around with their genitalia out.
Right.
But it's impossible for anyone to know what
Who
really
knows
happened. Because
or not, right.
Yeah. Who knows?
And you know, the thing is, I found myself thinking about it where I was like, and this is like, it feels like a silly line of thought, but at the same time, it was kind of instructive that I was like, well, you know, in my mind's eye, I see two possibilities, and I kind of see these two images in the minds of the respective parties of the dueling camps. One of them is somebody who presents as a woman, is wearing women's clothes, and, you know, passes as a woman, except that she has a penis, is in the locker room and is changing and her penis is showing, versus the other image is like somebody who has a beard and a hairy back and absolutely doesn't pass at all as a woman, but has like some lipstick applied, you know, and like swinging their dick around. And it's like, and it actually yeah. does make a difference to my perception of the, like, it's like, you know,
yeah,
being trans
Definitely.
A year ago, or like maybe 2 years ago, you know, like to be trans, you were doing something pretty bold. You were presenting yourself as a member of the opposite gender before society. But now it's like especially with online, it's like all you have to do is just declare that you're trans. You don't have to do anything, right? You don't even have to wear lipstick. You can just like, you don't have to shave your beard. And you're just like, well, I'm gender non-binary, I'm gender queer, or I identify as a female, even though I have a fucking beard and back hair. Like, if you're not even going to put any effort into it, then it's like, well, can you now just go to a women's college, or, you know, walk into a women's space, walk into a women's locker room, women's bathroom, or like, you know, a women's like reading group or something like that, and then demand that you be acknowledged as a woman, even though you haven't even put, you know, you're not even trying to pass as a woman. You're not doing even lifting a finger. And I think the answer from the trans activist side is yes. Like, yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. But there's no litmus test for if you declare yourself a woman, then you are a woman and everybody's morally obligated to treat you as a woman. And that is a total rejection of any right at that point for women to have their own spaces.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's really, it's increasingly becoming more complex. In a way that, yeah, makes the whole conversation and like discourse around it incredibly like fraught.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said before, like there's this sort of incentive on both sides of the argument to make the other side out to be like complete demons,
mm-hmm.
Which I don't think is like productive at all. I don't necessarily know what the answer is. And I can't say that I don't talk about this stuff with at least some trepidation because of how, you know, Yeah, it's scary because of how fucking mad people get at you if you don't have like the correct line. But the thing is, even among trans people, there's no consensus. I've spoken to trans people who, you know, say yes, that there's no real need for women's spaces in modernity or spaces for, you know, quote unquote, cisgendered women in modernity. And I've spoken to trans women who also believe that women should be have entitled to their own spaces and shouldn't have to see a penis when they're changing if they don't want to. So yeah, there's no real consensus on this issue, except for in terms of like what is legislated. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that this issue is something that can necessarily be worked out purely through like legislature, you know?
Yeah.
And it seems as if that's what these sort of right wing types are trying to do. They're trying to sort of wage this war on like a legislative front. And I just don't think it's a fight that like they could win. I think it would probably exacerbate and reify a lot of the baseless and overreacting claims of the other side if they do that.
Yeah. This might get me into some hot water saying this, but I think that there is, I mean, on the one hand, just using your sort of dichotomy between people within the trans community and their opinions on these issues. You know, on the one hand, you have like somebody like Buck Angel, who is a, you know, porn actor who transitioned, I don't know, 15 years ago or something, a long time, you know, a lifetime ago compared to the stuff coming into the sort of the common imagination. And he is a man with a vagina who makes a living being fucked in his vagina on screen, right? He's a porn actor, and he is considered a transphobe now by trans activists, including people who transitioned last week, you know, and who haven't even contemplated surgery or anything like that. Don't even cross dress, calling him a transphobe, because of his opinions on this stuff. And I get the sense that there are people who are actual trans people who have had gender dysphoria. And I'm not trying to say that gender dysphoria is a litmus test for whether you're really trans or not. I know that's a whole debate about trans medicalists and stuff, but there are those who have had gender dysphoria, who have had surgery, who have, at the very least been trying to pass as the opposite gender on a daily basis for a long time, who then are, you know, protective of their own rights, understandably so. And then you have people who I feel like are claim to be trans, but are doing it in a totally cynical way, almost just as a provocative kind of earnestly felt but trollish behavior, where it's like, I'm going to push the margins of what we can define as trans just to get you to react to it, so I can call you a transphobe. And on the other hand, you have like people on the other side who are just like, anything that smacks of bending these categories, they're going to immediately reach for. It's not even about the issue of being trans anymore. It's just about assuming the moral posture on one side or the other of this argument, and then using that as a weapon to club everybody else over the head. You know, like people. It reminds me of that. Sorry, I'm going on and on, but it reminds me, just as so many situations now do, of that episode of Seinfeld where with Bryan Cranston, where Bryan Cranston plays Seinfeld's dentist, and he converts to Judaism so that he can make anti-Semitic jokes. I literally feel like there are people who are willing to like embrace a trans identity and transition, whatever that means, just in order to be able to have the woke points and, you know, beat other people at Twitter arguments.
Yeah. Well, it's not just that. I mean, especially because online, a lot of this stuff is like linked to aesthetics and signifiers and not necessarily how one's lifestyle is like lived in the real world. It's like a very easy thing to sort of don and discard. And then there's also the fact that like any sort of identity these days is used as like a battling ram, like I said, to either get institutional perks or some kind of cultural access, or voice in that sense. So I feel like it, overlooking those incentives would be incredibly remiss if we want to really dig beneath the surface of why like identity politics has become like so fraught on all sides these days as well. And yeah, it's exhausting. And like I said, like there's no consensus. It's like not, like I said, it's not even possible to have complicated feelings or dig into them. because the conversation is so fraught, and anybody who, you know, tries to risk being institutionally blackballed or socially like ostracized in that sense. So it's like, it's very like, it's very scary and like fraught territory. Mm-hmm. But moving on, I thought it would be interesting if we talked about the John McAfee death, mm-hmm. which has gotten my, I'm like a crazy crackpot weirdo. And like, it's taken me down like a rabbit hole over the last couple of days. And my tinfoil hat is stinging. So, Jake, would you like to sort of introduce John McAfee a little bit, talk about what he is?
Sure. So, like, John McAfee is like a modern-day pirate. is like the best way I can describe it. He's he was this, well, obviously, McAfee comes from, like, the virus security software and stuff that he sold in, like, the late 80s for several, like, I can't remember, it was millions of dollars, but that was obviously a lot more money back in the day. And yeah, he's just been doing mad shit ever fucking since. And then been wanted by all kinds of different laws and authorities and stuff. I think from the tax evasion was what he was extradited for, which was then what he killed himself over, which I'm of two minds. I don't really, I'm actually on the fence as to whether he... What's it, Epstein?
Well, he did do a tweet that said that he wouldn't kill himself. And he also had that like weird, I think, tattoo or something that was like, if I kill myself, it's like not real or whatever. But then again, he is the kind of guy who would do something like that.
He's the kind of guy that once he died, he programmed like a picture of Q to come up on his Twitter.
Yeah, but he was very, the thing that's interesting about him and the thing that, so he's quote unquote killed himself in jail. And the interesting thing that's come up about it is that before he died, he was sort of very entwined in like QAnon and also was adamant that the Clintons were trying to kill him. And you know, gave all of this, and then also he had this like weird tie to Epstein as well. There was speculation that he was the one that released the drone footage of Little Saint Bart, the Epstein Island or whatever. And you know, there's all this speculation that maybe he was in on some secret and they, you know, offed him. But I can understand why the tinfoil hats would be tingling, because I guess the official narrative around this sort of thing has been so discredited, especially since the whole Epstein thing, that people are skeptical about whether or not McAfee actually, you know, killed himself.
Yeah. I mean, for me, I think that actually end up getting extradited to America would be the thing. I don't think that he would want to die in an American prison. It's an adventure to be in a Belizean prison or, you know, in Spain. It fits McAfee. It fits exactly his story. But to, like, wind up dying, like, fucking withered and whatever as an old man in American prison like that, I don't think that he would want that death. And I think that and it's part of the whole fight. He's a big joke. He's a massive joker. He is, like, the trickster archetype, like, all the way. And, out of all the people in the world that ever had money, I kind of respect him the most just because he did all the most, like, crazy... He, like, synthesized his own bath salts and shit and
he
was experimenting with himself.
Yeah, he killed a man. Like, where is this going? Where is this going?
Know, but still, it's a lot more exciting than Bill Gates. That, like, you know, he tried to fucking blow the dust.
But so you're saying
the sky to like block out.
So
the sun
you're saying
that one
you prefer
time,
these like adolescent billionaires instead of the like
fun.
Instead of the like old dusty like.
He's dangerous, but he's fun.
What do you think? Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
I was going to say he's like Trump in that he's like a poor man's idea of a rich man. You know,
which would exactly. It's like a poor like stoner bros idea of what a rich man, like a broke ass like college stoner bros idea of what a rich man is. Do you think about this whole?
I think that, okay, so first of all, I think that Jeffrey Epstein did not kill himself. I am absolutely convinced of that.
Yes.
I think that John McAfee did kill himself, and the reason why is because all of the evidence that's trotted out that he set up to argue against his killing himself, to me, is just as compelling evidence that he did kill himself, just because if you think about a guy named John McAfee, and just, like, start with the premise that... he was capable of contemplating taking his own life. Now, if you imagine that scenario, exactly how is John McAfee going to engineer it? Is he just going to go and slit his wrists? No, of course not. Like, of course he's going to cook up this huge fable. Of course he's going to tattoo himself. Of course he's going to do all the things that he did seem like absolutely consistent with what a guy like John McAfee would do before offing himself. You know, so for me, I find that just as compelling evidence that he did than that he didn't.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true. But then back to this sort of Jeff Epstein case, the fact that they had some kind of tenuous link is what is sort of making people's conspiracy like wires get crossed in that sense. Because there was an image of him and Epstein together. Like, it's been crazy. Like,
I wouldn't be surprised if like McAfee was selling his crazy fucking sexy bath salts to Epstein to do all of his fucked up sex rituals and shit.
Who knows?
Because
who
like
knows?
The kind of reports that were like given from like that his like compound in Belize or whatever were literally that he would have sex for multiple days.
Yeah.
So it like, you know, this isn't Viagra or Cialis this guy's cooking up. This is like serious shit.
It's insane. It's insane though, because the conspiracy wires have been going crazy since his death. Like the links to him, the Clinton thing are being like, you know, extrapolated upon. Same thing with the fact Bill Cosby is even being dragged into it, because apparently Bill Cosby lived across the street from Epstein as well. He owned an apartment in New York. Not an apartment, like a stately brownstone or whatever.
It is a convenient place to have a brownstone when you are a sex criminal, isn't it?
But that's
live opposite the most prolific and well-documented fucking sex criminal ever.
Speculation.
Coincidences are a damned thing.
But yeah, there's been all kinds of conspiracies running around about this. And obviously I am kind of agnostic about it all, but I think that, like I said, the official narrative has been so kind of, it's been incredibly, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, it's being disregarded simply because like people don't really trust official narratives anymore. And people are trying to sort of, you know, like do the working out of reality in like real time. And I think that now that politics, especially for like everyday, like working class people, has no real tenuous kind of potential, I think conspiracy is going to become a lot more of a force than it has been. And I mean, it's already been quite a large political force, but I think we're entering into like a new age of like conspiracy. what do you think about this?
I think that, so a couple of years ago, when the QAnon started and, you know, these conspiracy theories were flying all over the place, Pizzagate, et cetera, and starting to look more and more ominous, you know, I kind of bought the line that this is like a major emerging threat in our media ecosystem and in our politics. And I don't have any reason to believe that it is any less of a threat now, but I do think that, you know, things have turned such that like, the media, I know we're going to talk about the lab leak stuff at some point, but the lab leak stuff to me, the thing that was most alarming about the media's absolute denial of the lab leak stuff, and they're tarnishing it as a conspiracy theory before making a complete 180 based on really no new revelations, but just sort of like the incremental accumulation of evidence that that kind of made their position weaker and weaker until they finally just admitted it. It's just like now whenever the media calls something a conspiracy theory, you have to wonder whether it's a conspiracy theory or whether it's literally like the disinformation from the media is the disinformation, you know, like the calling things, calling the lab leak a conspiracy theory. Now there's the stuff around like ivermectin. Is ivermectin a total bullshit quack, wonder drug cooked up by like cynical hucksters, a danger to mankind if they have their way, or is it a legitimate medicine which could be saving hundreds of thousands, if not millions of lives, that is being covered up because pharmaceutical corporations would lose billions of dollars if it were allowed onto the market? Who knows? It's like, I can't tell anymore. Like, I have no purchase, and I'm a pretty close reader of the news. I can't read I can't trust what I read the New York Times anymore. It is too ideologically freighted. And mm-hmm, so like, so like, you know, so it's become just much, much worse because now there's the existence of these conspiracy theories out there. But then like, I just feel like gaslit, like I, you know, I have, I think very rational reasons, for example, to believe that ivermectin may be a legit, drug for treating COVID. And if it is, then the implications of why it has been kept off the market are very, very disturbing. Like the fact that, you know, vested interests are allowing people to die, allowing a pandemic to continue to spiral out of control in order to keep a drug off the market that would cost them their bottom line is a bleak, bleak sort of would be a bleak, bleak sort of revelation and epiphany about the world. On the other hand, at other times, I'm like, wait, like, if I was talking to myself about ivermectin 5 years ago, would I myself be looking at myself like a 9/11 truther, like being like, you know, because I actually find myself saying things like, but you don't understand, the media has been covering this up. And, you know, like, have you read this report or that report? And just like, and I start feeling like I'm talking about, like, you know, the melting temperature of steel beams or something. You know, it's like, I don't,
what about Building 7?
Yeah, exactly. Like, I don't know.
No, but that's the thing. Like the whole like Alex Jones was right jar meme isn't like rooted in just like pure cynicism at this point. Like I feel like everybody is becoming a unhinged 9/11 truther now. It's like it's impossible to sort of grasp hold of any kind of coherence in the current like climate. And interestingly enough, my mom actually sent me a cheeky dose of ivermectin from Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because she said she swears by it.
Yeah, it's all over.
And
Africa.
She's like, yeah, and it's because we used it to treat malaria,
right? And river
in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. And I've had ivermectin before when I was young because I went to Nigeria when I was I think 7 or 8 and I got a very bad case of malaria while I was there.
Mm-hmm.
And they just sort of treat it like the common cold over there. Cause like everyone has had malaria at some point or whatever, but it knocked the shit out of me. And I remember having to take that drug in order to like recover. But yeah, my mom like swears by it and like sent me a whole dose. I haven't taken it yet. Cause I don't know what the fuck it is, but like,
well, in India, there's like a group of doctors that have like taken the World Health Organization to court or something around, them not being able to, prescribe it. In India, I think,
and a bunch of states. And a bunch of states in India just started using it, and in those states, like I think in particular in Goa, cases have plummeted. Whereas in Tamil Nadu, they made it illegal, and cases skyrocketed. And the same thing has happened, like in Mexico, has been used to great success. And actually, in Africa, one hypothesis is that the reason that COVID-19 has been relatively contained in Africa is because so many people have taken ivermectin that it's a prophylaxis. They've already been treated before the virus even emerged. That's one hypothesis. I'm not a scientist. Yeah. I can't judge the empirical evidence behind it, but like it sounds compelling to me.
Yeah. Also, the Africa has like dealt with a lot of pandemics.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, especially in Nigeria, there was like an outbreak of Ebola. There's like outbreaks of Ebola every couple of years, and this and that. So like, whenever there is some kind of pandemic, the response is super fucking fast and often draconian, which isn't great. I'm not gonna. But yeah, the response is super fast in that sense. But yeah, it's been back to the whole like lab leak situation. It's definitely been something that's intrigued me. Would you like to sort of extrapolate more on that?
Yeah. I've been sort of a nerd about this for the last year. I mean, I wasn't like super ahead of the curve, but I think that I was paying a little bit of attention to it when it was still widely discredited. So I've been watching it for a while, but you know, like at this point there's that thing that Jon Stewart delivered, which I thought was funny, although you know he was pretty late to this particular ship. But you know the point that he made is really the case for it having been a lab leak. Like it's like the outbreak was in the same city as one of three labs in the world that do gain of function research on bat coronaviruses. It happened to break out in that city. the chain of events that would lead to an outbreak through a lab leak is very straightforward. It's like, we know that there was this predecessor virus that broke out in this cave in Guangdong province, I think, in southern China. That was the closest relative to COVID-19. We know that the bat lady, quote unquote, who's the head of the lab at Wuhan, had traveled down to that cave and then extracted that virus and brought it back to the Wuhan Institute of Virology. We know that they were doing gain-of-function research on other viruses at the Wuhan Institute of Virology, which means just weaponizing these viruses, making them more transmissible, more deadly to humans, in order to find ways to counteract it, which is just a whole crazy mad scientist thing in its own right. But we know that all these things happened. And so then the chain of events is like, okay, well, with all that in place, perhaps a technician had enhanced this virus, and perhaps a technician broke a beaker or something and it escaped. That's to me, like, the fact that people called that a conspiracy theory to me is like, what? Now I can't trust anything that you could call a conspiracy theory, because this is the most straightforward, like, this is the most straightforward, rational, obvious series of events that would lead to the outbreak. Mm-hmm. Whereas the natural spillover hypothesis, you know, it started falling apart from almost the moment it was proposed. Like, it was supposed to have emerged from the wet market. Now we know that Chinese researchers have found cases that that preceded the wet market outbreak. So the wet market was definitely a super spreader event, but it was not patient zero was not in the wet market. The wet market was supposed to be the place where we found this intermediate species. Like, you have to have the virus. The relative of this virus that was found in that bat cave was very difficult to transmit to human beings. These miners got it, but they were inhaling bat guano for like 3 days as they were shoveling this stuff, and they got it, and then they got into this, and they were put in a hospital setting, and all of tons of healthcare workers around them, and none of them got it. So clearly, it was very difficult. It was possible, but very difficult to transmit to human beings. Now you have coronavirus. COVID-19, which is exceptionally effective at transmitting to human beings, and my understanding is that it cannot be transmitted back to bats. So, like, something had to occur along that causal chain of events to cause those mutations. And if you had many, many interfaces between human beings and bats, where there were many, many, many opportunities for this virus to attempt to make the leap from one species to another, You would expect that it could possibly make that leap, because there'd be many opportunities for a mutation to be successful and make that leap. But that's not the case. You don't have like some interface with tons and tons of exposure between bats and human beings. You just have this one incident with these mines. So therefore, you have to have, in order to bear this out, an intermediate species. You have to say, well, there were two hops, the bat to this intermediate species and this intermediate species to human beings. And the hypothesis of the wet market was that pangolins were that intermediate species. And the only reason they settled on pangolins is because pangolins had been intermediate species in prior viral outbreaks. But it turns out that there were no pangolins for sale at the wet market at the time. So that's off the table. So there's no intermediate species. There's no event that they can point to where there was tons of interfacing between humans and these bats. The bats were thousands of miles away from where the outbreak occurred. It was hibernation season at the time. So like, the chain of events that you would have to put together in order to point to natural spillover starts to sound like a conspiracy theory. Like, that starts to sound like extremely unlikely.
Yeah.
Kind of kooky.
Yeah. The opposite of what?
Yeah. And so it's, to me, it's like the whole thing is completely flipped and inverted. And now I'm left being like, I obviously want to know how the outbreak started, but to me, the thing I'm more focused on and alarmed by is the fact that the media was calling it, because this is what it says about the media, and therefore what it says about what I can understand about the world by reading the media. Because I'm just like, it's as if the media had been saying 9/11 was an inside job for 2 years, and then all of a sudden they were saying, oh, Bin Laden did it, or the reverse, right? They've been saying 9/11 is a conspiracy.
Yeah.
Like, imagine if right now, all of a sudden, some like evidence came, like the New York Times started saying, oh, turns out 9/11 was an inside job. Your world would be turned upside down, right? And so that's what I feel like is the consequence of the lab leak. But you know, most people.
It's also how much you trust the Chinese government, because they right. did their own internal investigation right. and they determined that it wasn't a lab leak, but they refused any other kind of external investigation for some kind of reason.
Right.
Look, I already told you we will not have one bad word said about China on this podcast. Okay, we stand China.
We're not doing numbers in China. Trust me. Okay.
I know. I'm just hoping for like a check one day.
Some sort of cultural ministry job.
Yeah, to like defect. That's like my plan B in case this fails. But yeah, it's crazy how the entire narrative, like the way you just explained, like the entire narrative just like flipped on its head. But not only that, sort of the punitive discourse that was surrounding the idea that it came out of China to begin with, like everybody who... it was like a lab leak sort of thing. Everybody who said that initially was sort of like, you're crazy,
right.
you're a kook.
I think
feel like
part
this...
of it was because Trump said it.
No, absolutely.
Well, yeah, there was...
If yeah. you repeat anything Trump says...
100%.
Even if it's true.
Yeah.
You do sound a little bit crazy.
The only but, reason ivermectin stands a chance is because... It just happens to be that Trump never mentioned ivermectin. Like, he mentioned hydroxychloroquine or whatever it's called. So therefore, that is completely outlandish. But, you know, it's just like it's completely ass backwards.
My grandma, like, loves Trump. Mm-hmm. And, like, when I was ill, I was sick, but I didn't have COVID, but I had, like, a bit of a mild flu. And she was, like, yelling at me in her Nigerian accent. And she was like, President Trump said that if you take, what's it called, hydroxychloroquine or whatever, it will cure you. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. She was like, it'll cure you. And then she sent me a bunch of it and like swore that it would like cure me, but I didn't take it because again, I don't know what it is. But yeah, it's been so insane to watch how the official narrative is sort of in flux at the moment. And that's the reason why I feel like it's going to open up this whole new culture of conspiracy where everybody is going to be, you know, in their own sort of official narrative.
Yeah, well, because...
Sorry,
go ahead.
Sorry, I was just going to say, I don't think that people, especially in America and the UK, are like trained to sort of critically examine information. People are really used to like received wisdom.
Right.
And I feel like the fact that everything is in flux now is going to create like a bunch of chaos. And I don't necessarily see that as like an alarmist thing or necessarily something that may... automatically result in like, you know, ontological chaos, but I'm just interested to see where the ride goes.
Yeah, well, you see in the media, like serious people and in politics, like serious minded or serious looking at least people saying things like, well, we cannot conclude that it was a lab leak because then that will cause racism against Chinese people. And it's like, I understand the concern, but like the idea that you are seriously proposing that we cannot accept one version of reality because of the possible like social implications of accepting that reality, to me, it's like, okay, we have no, mm-hmm. like you're openly admitting that, that you have no actual empirical basis for rejecting this theory other than you don't want to believe that it's true. Because it's a dangerous truth to accept. And so like this came to like, I mean,
but that's the whole,
go ahead.
Sorry, go ahead. Sorry.
I was real kind of like red pilled at the moment in which, I don't know if you recall that like during the summer protests after George Floyd's murder, there was this letter signed by like 500 scientists or something saying that, you know, starting off by saying, okay, we want to be clear. The right-wing protests against lockdowns were reckless and white supremacist and dangerous. But the protests against police brutality are righteous, and we should all participate in them, even though it's going to be incredibly difficult to social distance and mask and all that stuff, because structural racism is every bit as dangerous of a pandemic as COVID-19. And
yeah,
it was like,
yeah.
These are scientists saying this. And it was like, I was like, I don't know if you guys have read Martin Gurry's book, The Revolts of the Public, but it's all about the crisis in expertise. And it's like, it's almost like these experts are rushing to discredit themselves. It's like, if I can't that, to me, I was like, when I read that letter, I was like, I can't, there's no credibility left for self-appointed experts. These are there were like Nobel Prize winners signed onto that letter.
But I mean, that's the thing, you know, that's exactly what wokeness is. And you see it in stuff like CRT, sorry, all of this stuff, you know, it's kind of a total ontological overhaul of reality in that sense. And, you know, the system will tap into whatever ideology that it feels it can use to justify itself and whatever it feels it can use to kind of mystify information that it doesn't want out. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't matter what's objectively true. What matters is how we can sort of use wokeness as like a moral justification to steer people away from things that are kind of challenging some powerful interest.
Right.
And yeah, that's kind of what I see, is it's a complete ontological like attack on like reality. I mean, you see it in the case of like critical race theory as well, where, you know, it's like it sort of encourages people to view things as totally racialized. And they sort of try to push through this like totalizing trans-historical narrative of oppression. But whenever you look behind it, it's only ever really serving the interests of power.
Yeah.
It has nothing to do with like, you know, things that are going to, you know, create concessions economically for like poor and working class, like people of color. And yeah, the sort of ignoring that you're seeing isn't just rooted in this kind of zany, you know, misstep by the media. I think it has a lot of like power and like interests like behind it. And this is just sort of a moral cover that they're using to like make sure that we don't dig where we're not supposed to.
Yeah. There was an episode of Red Scare a little while ago where they talked about Foucault and how Foucault, you know, a lot of people have blamed Foucault and the discourse that he started for the current reality that we're in which truth is considered to be, objective truth is considered to be sort of this fiction, which is subservient to power. Right. But, mm-hmm. but I objected to that episode. And I wrote a piece on my Substack about it actually, because I've read Foucault quite extensively, and this was actually, he far from being the progenitor of this discourse, this is exactly what he warned of. Like, he talked about the emergence mm-hmm, of these mm-hmm. discourses that construct a new reality, that literally, like, for example, in the history of sexuality, he talks about the construction of the homosexual, which, you know, before there was a social construction of the figure of the homosexual, there weren't homosexuals before. There were people who had a desire to sleep with other people of the same sex, but they weren't considered a type of person until mm-hmm. they were constructed mm-hmm. into this kind of like medicalized subject. And then that allowed that created a discourse about the origins of homosexuality that allowed the state to then like incarcerate them and, you know, do in order to, you know, for their good and to do all this kind of social and then sort of monitor people's sex lives and get up all into their business. And so it was like the creation of these social objects, this creation of these these discourses emerge in order to create a new reality to subject people to power. That's what this woke discourse is. That's certainly what like the whole like Robin mm-hmm. DiAngelo, you know, Ibram X. Kendi yeah, kind of interrogate interrogate your own racism. Every, you know, if you're a white person, you have to have like, you know, cleanse your soul of your inborn racism, all this stuff. Is exactly mm-hmm, what mm-hmm. It's far from what Foucault created. It's what he was warning against, which is this construction of this discourse that creates this new idea, white supremacy is a new object in the world now. Now we have to monitor each other for white supremacy, and your employer gets to monitor you at work for your white supremacy, and HR can call you in and discipline mm-hmm. you for your white supremacy. Mm-hmm. Blah 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 blah. And it's mm-hmm. like it's this whole new apparatus of power that's been constructed by this discourse.
They're very fair rules. It's three strikes you out, three microaggressions, and you're gone. It's not, you know, you should learn after the first two. I feel like you have a third that you deserve, in my opinion.
Silliness. But what was I saying? No, it's interesting though, because like it's also affecting history as well. And I guess that's kind of where I kind of break from the postmodern paradigm, in the sense that, you know, there's this sort of rapid deterritorialization that's like being facilitated by this stuff. Like you see a lot of these proponents of this kind of like things like CRT and other stuff like that, basically making these like grand ahistorical claims, ones that even border on like racial like essentialism in that sense. You know, also kind of, there's also like a paternalism that's attached to it as well. There's this kind of like, it's like a bigotry of low expectations in that sense. There's this idea, like the whole thing where that, you know, the SAT math requirements were being lowered for Black students.
Yeah.
You know, instead of them funding, you know, schools better, they're like, oh, enjoy your illiteracy, Black children, because white supremacy. And that's what I mean when I say this stuff always works in tandem with whatever the system is like already doing.
And let's be real, the reason why white liberals are in favor of lowering standards in for Black students and is the same reason why white liberals will make up excuses for Black criminality, which is that they are racist and they don't expect any better. Like basically the idea is,
well,
these kids are never going to accomplish what the white kids do. So we need to normalize it by saying that's okay. Oh, well, Black people, they're just criminal. They just act criminally. So we need to say that that's okay and that's acceptable. And it's like, no, if you don't subscribe to this race craft, then your point of view is, no, there are reasons why Black people are underperforming. Some of them are racism. Some of it is about poverty. Some of it is an intersection of all these things. But there is no, like, there's nothing, there's no reason to lower standards because there's no standards that a white person can meet that a Black person can't meet by virtue of the fact that they're Black. That's the, you know, the most elementary form of racism.
Exactly.
It feeds into, like, right-wing racism as well, doesn't it?
But it's, that's what I mean when I say it's just two sides of the same reactionary coin constantly at war
that,
with
like,
each other.
That proves their point exactly. Yeah. If they start to do stuff like that, then, oh, you couldn't achieve what we achieved because you had to have a lower standard.
Right.
Because, you know, you're Black.
Yeah, even in academia as well, there's especially like one of the major proponents of CRT is that, you know, things like objectivity and, you know, rationality and, you know, measured sort of academic distance in that sense is considered inherently white, you know, apparently authenticity, having an authentic voice is considered like politically Black in that sense. So there's this sort of thing. Yeah, it's disgusting. It's so evil. It's so evil. It's this sort of claim that, you know, Black people are incapable of being objective and like being literate in the canon.
Or
like
punctual.
It's really, really disturbing.
Yeah.
Yeah. Or punctual or any of those things. Yeah. It's really, really disturbing to see. And yeah, you're seeing this sort of ontological overhaul happen in all kinds of different places. Yeah. But like I said, it always seems to work in tandem with whatever the system is doing. It seems to sort of give a convenient excuse to kind of do away with the root causes of these disparities by like assigning arbitrary meaning to the, you know, result of the disparity.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, it's very frustrating. It's really, really frustrating and sad. And I'm afraid for, you know, what's going to happen in the next couple of years. Cause I don't think any of this stuff can be fought legislatively.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a force of nature. And I think the only way that it can really be challenged is through like broad class struggle.
Mm-hmm.
Other than that, we're pretty much fucked and there's no real sign of broad class struggle happening anytime soon either. So it's like, I know I'm a little bit black-pilled in that sense, but yeah, it's just kind of like, what the fuck? But I feel like the thing that terrifies me the most is that I'm afraid that the right wing are going to attempt, or the far right are going to attempt to sort of do an identitarian like response reaction to all of the stuff that we're seeing. And it's just going to end up reifying all of the warped premises of like the liberal left at the moment. And we're just going to be caught in this endless like sort of battle between these two reactionary sides.
Yeah. I mean, I think that they already have done that with the alt-right. And I feel like, you know, the alt-right is just the flip side of wokeness, right? It's just white identitarianism. It subscribes to all the same basic premises of racecraft. And I think that, I mean, this is, I guess, the hopeful part of me thinks that, you know, lots of people, including, you know, I assume the three of us, reject, like, they're in the same bucket, and we reject that whole set of assumptions. And so, like, you know, the right wing reactionary, they like for those who do not subscribe to the racial suppositions of wokeness are, you wouldn't imagine that they would tend to then logically gravitate towards embracing exactly those assumptions, but in defense of white people, right? It's like, we're just, this whole thing is bullshit. There's no such thing as race. Race is a fiction. It's a social construct. You know, it's like, you know, this whole discourse is geared towards dividing people and encouraging hatred. And you know, we want nothing to do with either of you, with either of these kind of disgusting camps, you know, the alt-right Antifa, these lunatic poles.
Yeah.
I think there's enough fatigue out there for like that to happen. Like politically, you know, everyone's kind of tired of the constant bullshit of it all, I think.
Mm-hmm. I had an experience just today. This is kind of neither here nor there, but there's a, I was trying to set up a play date for my infant son with somebody who, she's a South Asian woman who has a baby about my son's age. And we were trying to set up a play date, and it was all going along. We were just by text. I've never actually met her before, like in person, but this was by text. So I don't know her, but this was by text. And it was like, you know, we'd been trying to plan these logistics. And then we'd finally kind of settled down on a date and a time. And then I said, oh, by the way, your daughter's name is really cute. That's what I said. And then, she responded with like, so her daughter's name is Hindi. And, I mean, that's not her name, but her name is in Hindi. And she said, you know, when people go out of their way to compliment my daughter's name, sometimes this is probably not how you meant it, but I feel like it otherizes, like my family my culture.
Oh God.
And basically was expecting me to apologize for it. And long story short, we're no longer doing the play date. Like this is like, this is off the table. We like, you know, but good. I was like, the funny thing is that like, you know, I live in the East Bay area in California. Like I'm very, cognizant of the sort of the mentality of certain people. So at the time that I said this totally anodyne comment, by the way, your daughter's name is really cute, it actually occurred to me that I was like, maybe she'll take this the wrong way. And then I was like, first of all, of course she won't, because that's ridiculous. And she seems like a sensible person. And second of all, if she does take it that way, then I know, then that's like a good red flag for me. Then I know, like, get, you know, get the fuck out of Dodge. I was still shocked when she actually did take it that way. And like, I feel gaslit as I was having this conversation with her. Cause I was like, the whole thing, I kept coming, she was like, we were arguing like the racial implications of like making these assumptions. And I was like, and I kept going back to the original statement, which was, oh, by the way, your daughter's name is cute. And I was like, this is, you know, this isn't on Twitter. This is in real life. Like, I can't say somebody's daughter's name is cute.
That's so fucking scary.
This debate, this political debate, you know, is insane.
Wow. Well, you see, it's not quite two separate, is it? It's still interfacing through the phone. So you still kind of got that separation. If it was like you met this woman,
if somebody is going to do that over text about a play date, they'll definitely do that to your face. Like that kind of
I don't think so.
I do. People are like,
it's
super
a different kind of confidence.
No, people are super narcissistic, and they are always looking for ways to one up other people, hoard virtue, claim the moral high ground, and monger grievance. Mm. And like, even in the most like benign interactions, like organizing a play date for two infants, you know, there are people who are looking for that kind of social leverage.
Yeah.
And yeah, fuck her. I'm glad you didn't send your infant son to go play with her daughter, even though they would have probably had fun.
Yeah, they would have
but
had fun.
Her mom's a...
Yeah. But we dodged
They would
the
have been fine. Yeah, definitely. How old's your son?
11 months.
Oh, yeah. Do they, are they even social at that age? Do they like care about other babies
not,
at that
not
age?
Not really, but what they'll do is they'll like play in the presence of another baby. They don't like play with the other baby, but they'll like play alongside them. And that's sort of like introductory to, you know, eventually like in no time at all, they'll start
being socialized.
Yeah.
Oh, that's
and we just
sweet.
Wanted
that's
to
sweet.
Meet
but
more
yeah,
parents
only...
with kids, you know, it's just like, you know, just to like,
yeah, of course. Yeah.
It always like, starts innocently, doesn't it?
But it's like dating. It's like dating, though. You're going to go on a few duds before you finally find some, like, based, cool parents.
Totally.
Who
and
are
in
not
this case, it was, like,
you.
Online dating. It was, like, we were still in the, like, DMing thing. And it was, like, I actually literally said in the thread, I think that we're probably not compatible with each other, and so we just shouldn't meet up. And I was like, it really felt like I was on Hinge
oh
or something.
God. Oh my God, that's so funny. That's so funny. Oh my God. That's like a weird, like, swingers vibe or whatever. Like you're trying to, like, eye out other couples.
I know, it feels
whatever.
Dirty. You know? Should it's like do, I'm just trying to set up a play date for two babies.
You should do an art series where you try and meet up with a lot of these ones, but then you also snapshot, you know, Bumble conversations or something, and just see which you have to play the game, which is which, and
which is a parent trying to set up a play date for this one, which is someone trying to get laid yeah. on Oh my God, yeah. But yeah, thank you so much for coming sure. on. One last question, and this is a frivolous question before we round up that we ask every guest that comes on. What is your astrology sign?
Oh God. I'm Aquarius, which I'm actually told suits me.
Me too. Right. Me too. Me too. That's so cool. That's awesome. Yeah, I knew. I felt it. Oh I felt gosh. The vibe. I felt the affinity from over here for sure. That's awesome. What are you? Do you think astrology is just for crazy women? Was that misogyny that I just heard it, coming out of your mouth?
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, it was. But I will also note. Well, who was it who said something about? I think it was actually Anna from Red Scare. Somebody else said that. Watching the stock market is like horoscopes for men. So
it is. You know, I agree.
We have our version.
Yeah, like watching the stock market, buying like weird skins in your games or whatever the fuck it is.
The thing is, in me, like, you know, I enjoy magicians and all sorts of like fun, you know, magic or whatever. But you can't say like, what are you? Oh yeah! Oh yeah! I absolutely felt that. I've got to start making you take a guess before the guest reveals, because then you can claim, "Oh, I knew it! I knew it! I felt that you were a Taurus, or we were both an Aquarius."
Yeah, you
got to
write it down on a piece of paper, and then do the reveal at the end.
Yeah, at the beginning you got to write it down, and then at the end.
I'm being bullied by toxic white males. Help me! Actually, you're half Asian, right?
I am. Yeah. Yes, I get like a.
So I just committed a microaggression. So you win.
My half Asianness is like has always bought me a like tiny bit of a POC card, but like since I'm half, and then to some people white passing, and then also Asians are white adjacent. It was a very weak card, and then when during the Stop API Hate thing, all of a sudden it was like a real fucking Trump card. And then that lasted about 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And now we're back to...
Oh my God. No, you got to leverage it for all the institutional power that you can get. I was going to ask to round out, now that you've brought it up, we can't not talk about it. What did you think about the whole Stop Asian Hate thing? And then what did you think about like the Tarantino Bruce Lee race kerfuffle that's been going on? Like, his daughter came out to chastise Tarantino for his depiction in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. First of all, what did you think about the Asian hate thing and then the Bruce Lee thing?
Okay, so first of all, I live in the Bay Area. The attacks on Asians are real. Like, that is a thing that's been happening. It's been happening for a lot longer than it's been in the national news. So I want to start by saying, before I move on to my opinion of it, I want to say that there's like it's a real thing and it's very disturbing. But I thought the whole Stop API thing, hate thing, was absolutely retarded. It was the same as like, I have a good friend of mine is black, and we used to make fun of during the George Floyd protest thing. Like I Venmo'd her like $5 in reparations, like as a joke, right? And she was like, fuck you. But then like when the Stop API thing came out, she was able to Venmo me like $250 for the half of me that's Asian. And she was like, hashtag Stop API.
Oh, wow.
And that's roughly how I feel about it. I mean, it's just the same. It's just like, yeah, that like, you know, anti-Black racism is real and police brutality is real, but you start off with a germ of something that's real and serious, and then it by the way, that same friend of mine who I did that Venmo exchange with is a producer in LA. She's a documentary producer, but she was working on this show around like Stop API Hate stuff. And basically the format was they got a bunch of celebrities to have dinner together, and they like had several of these. And so like these celebrities, and they're like Asian celebrities or Asian-ish celebrities. like Olivia Munn, for example, and they'd have them get together and then and just talk for a few hours. So these celebrities were paid. There were hosts and there were guests. And if you're a host, basically you had a few more responsibilities than the guests. The host's time, I think it took about like 3 hours of their day. They were paid $50,000. $50,000, wow, for a few hours of their time.
Wow.
And then the guests were all paid like $10,000 for basically like an hour and a half of their time to just sit around, wow, and eat really good food and talk to other famous people. They had a crew,
wow,
for this shoot of 120 people. That was how big the crew was. There were like seven cameras. Each camera has like three people on each, you know, like a camera operator and two assist camera. And like, this is like, I was like, this is a distillation of this whole, like there's Asian, like elderly Asian people on the streets of Oakland and San Francisco who are like fresh off the boat, speak no English, are like ancient, and they're getting curb stomped randomly then a movement forms around them. And then the upshot of that movement is a cutting funding for police, putting those people more at risk for further assault, and millionaire Asian celebrities being able to have like another payday. You know, it's like just all this stuff just trickles up to the elite and just becomes this absurd, charade. So that's what I think of the Stop API Hate thing. I think it was a joke.
Yeah. I mean, we really ought to get in on the grift, because I navel gaze all the time for free, and I would like to get paid for navel gazing. Like, we should definitely, like, what are we doing being principled? Like, ew, we should be like, you know, trying to get in on the clout.
Yeah.
But what did you think about the whole Bruce Lee thing as well?
Did you hear about this is the first I've heard of
you
it.
You didn't?
Yeah.
Really? Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's been so, because Tarantino was on Joe Rogan last week, mm-hmm, and he was talking about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and there's like a scene in it where Brad Pitt's character like kicks the shit out of Bruce Lee,
right,
and Bruce Lee is sort of portrayed to be this like cocky, like asshole type of person. Mm-hmm. And Tarantino sort of, you know, because he's like into old Hollywood history, and he knows that he sort of claims knowledge about Bruce Lee's character and how he was kind of a bit of an asshole and sort of saw himself as a bit of a big shot. And, you know, there were quite a few people who tried to sort of racialize it by saying Tarantino was being racist towards like the one Asian, like big Asian hero or whatever. And then Bruce Lee's daughter also came out and wrote an article where she was saying, I'm tired and sick and tired of these, you know, bloated white men in Hollywood, you know, trying to tarnish the legacy of, and it just turned into this like whole thing. It was really weird. It was really, I know, it was really silly to watch. I'm like, who cares if Tarantino thinks that like Bruce Lee was an asshole? Like, it's not the end of the world, and it's not like racism. It seems like it has no meaning anymore.
Right.
Like, the word just has no fucking meaning at this point. Like, it's just completely nonsense. But you're right when you say that this stuff just like trickles up. You know, it starts in this sort of grain, and it's the same thing with CRT. It starts on the premise, the true premise that like race is socially constructed, but then like changes that into like racial determinism, basically, and making race into this like purely ontological phenomenon rather than like a material one, but right. But yeah, we should definitely make a business plan on how we're gonna leverage our identities in 2022. Yeah,
business proposal.
Sorry, Jake, you're not invited. Yeah,
well, actually,
you're not invited, Jake, because you're a white.
You might be able to get in on it because I think the next big thing is going to be neurodivergence and whether or not you have a diagnosed mental disorder. There's no way for anybody to know whether you do or not. So anybody can claim that shit. So there's space for everybody on this train.
No,
Jake's neurodivergence is that he's a stoner, a chronic stoner.
Oh my god.
You can claim oppression
stoner
points for your
burn.
For your stoner
Big
life.
Burn.
Stoner lives matter, exactly. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Such a joy to have you on the show. Would you like to thank you. Would you like to replug all of your stuff just for the people in the audience that didn't catch it at the beginning?
For sure. Twitter is at L Woodhouse. L for Leighton. Woodhouse is my last name, and then I have a Substack, which is at leightonwoodhouse.substack.com, whatever the URL is. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much.
Absolutely.
And we shall catch you guys later. Goodbye.
Thanks. Bye.
Goodbye.
Thanks for listening, everyone. If you want to hear more from us, check us out on Twitter at lowsocietypod. You can write us an email at lowsocietypodcast@gmail.com. And you can support us on Patreon, where we give weekly bonus episodes. Just search for us over there on Patreon and you'll find us. $5 gets you the bonus episodes, $2 for the Discord where we can just, you know, hang out and chat shit. And then an extra special tier if you want to send us in like an audio question or even a video question if we're doing a video episode, and we can include it in the show as well. All right. Thanks for listening. Bye.